NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is good to see you guys. It's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. We're flying as a slight formation since we're missing Miles O'Brien, but he'll be back with us on a future show. So today, you know, one of the things that we bantered around before we went on air was the fact of what were we going to talk about. And we were planning on talking about pilots and mental health and some of the recent accidents, but we got to look at recent accidents in a different way. Over this past weekend, there were two fatal serious accidents that killed seven people, five in North Carolina and two in Provo, Utah. And in looking at both of those accidents, and I've seen a couple of articles on the internet, on some of the aviation websites, some of the headlines read, what's going on with Cirrus? And the question is, what is going on with Cirrus pilots? Because apparently it's the pilots and not necessarily the airplane. And years ago, when we first started this show, and I remember talking about some serious accidents, one of the big issues that we talked about was technology and the fact that, and I preach it all the time in my safety presentations, what pilots tend to lack in their own personal skills, abilities, and knowledge, they transfer that confidence that they lack into the airplane. Because they have an autopilot, because they have TAWS, because they have weather, because they have a parachute. And all of a sudden now they're doing things with the airplane, or they're not doing things with the airplane that they should be doing, or they don't have a very good fundamental understanding of the airplane that they're flying. And it's kick the tires, light the fire, let's rock and roll and go do stuff that puts them in a position of jeopardy. And in looking at this first accident in North Carolina, where you have four adults and a child on board a Cirrus SR22G6, which was issued certificates in 2023. So it's a relatively new airplane. It's got all the new whiz-bang avionics, the Garmin package, the NXI package. You know, it's a $1 million airplane. And so, of course, trying now, this pilot is trying to fly VFR into a very short runway, i.e. 3,000 feet at Kill Devil Hill, where, of course, the Wright brothers made that famous. That's the first flight airport that they were trying to get into. So let's start with that one before we talk about the SR-22 at Provo, Utah, with two fatals there. But again, talking about what's common between these two accidents that we're going to discuss, is that both of them were on abandoned approaches to a runway. And from the scant information that we do have that's out in the public, and of course, looking at the ADS-B data, it's evident that the pilot started his approach, the first approach, and for whatever reason, and we can talk about it because I'm pretty sure that we all know what the reason was, but abandoned that first approach and was coming back for a second approach when the accident sequence started. So Todd, I know that, you know, John had thrown a question out and you had made a comment about, and we preach it all the time, and John ends our shows with it all the time, about pre-flight planning. So now you got a pilot with this gee whiz airplane. He's loaded it up pretty much, not only with four people and a child, but you know you got gas on that airplane, so it's going to be relatively heavy. And you're trying to get into a 3,000-foot runway that has bad stuff on both ends. They were landing on runway 21. There's a stand of trees just about 100 feet high, only 350 feet off the end of the departure end of the runway. There's some high towers and power lines and a variety of other things. So having that kind of information, Todd, how would you plan to go into a short runway with all of that stuff on both the approach and departure end?
Well, there's a standard planning I would do with a runway and airport I am familiar with. But one of the questions I asked myself early on is there any evidence that this pilot was familiar with that runway? This just happened this past weekend, I think last Saturday. So, and we're doing this on Tuesday, so we don't have any official information from the NTSB. But looking at the FlightAware ADS-B data, the last time this aircraft, actually, the first time this aircraft had been to this airport since July 1st, which is as far back as I went, was on the accident flight. So I'm assuming here, that the pilot was the one flying all these previous flights, and the pilot didn't fly any other flights into this airport. Well, gee, it looks like this airplane had not been into Kill Devil Airport for at least 3 good months. Even if someone is familiar with an airport, if this is the first time this aircraft has been in this airport, it says to me, a question that should be asked is, how familiar was this pilot with this airport? Second thing, which jumped out right at me, this aircraft had 5 people on board, which was, I don't know how many seats are in the Cirrus, but I'm assuming that 5 is pretty close to full, 4 adults and 1 child.
It is.
And the average adult in the United States, as many of you know, is larger than average compared to 10 or 20 years ago. So another question I have is, what was the gross weight of this aircraft and how close was it to max gross weight? And again, flashing back to my history, I don't fly airplanes, small airplanes, that are fully packed with passengers that often, very rarely. And when I do, the airplane behaves noticeably differently. And I'm kind of a little bit more careful, a little bit more skittish about doing anything out of the ordinary when I have more than the average number of people on board. So are there a lot of risk factors piling up here? Unfamiliarity, large gross weight of the aircraft. And who knows? Was this child this person's child? Was the child sitting in the right front seat because the relative, perhaps a father or close relative, wanted to show this kid what it was like to fly the airplane? Could that have factored into what was going on in that cockpit?
Well, I can tell you that the child probably was not sitting in the seat in the right front seat because it's prohibited in a Cirrus aircraft, because the Cirrus aircraft do have deployable airbags in the shoulder harnesses. So kids are prohibited from sitting in that right front seat. There's a higher probability that this child was probably seated on someone's lap or between the two rear seat passengers. So now you also have to add not only to the weight, but to the center of gravity and doing a weight and balance, because that too is going to affect your performance, especially slow speeds. And John, you brought up a point before we went on the air, and that is you made the comment that, again, going into a short runway, you have to be right on. So your aim point is going to be the end of that runway, and you're going to have to adjust your approach, especially if you have obstructions, trees or power lines or whatever. Your approach profile is going to have to be steeper so that you clear all of that stuff. It can't be low and flat to land on the end of the runway. And so in talking about those kinds of things, and I know, again, you always end our show with pre-planning. This is something that, again, I know you got a high-performance airplane, but that airplane isn't going to save you when you don't do as the pilot should be doing. You don't do those things that are necessary to get the airplane in a proper configuration and in a proper position to make a successful landing.
If he's trying to dive to make the numbers, to land on the numbers, there's an unstabilized approach right there. I mean, we don't often talk about unstabilized approaches with single engine airplanes, but the same problems exist with those airplanes that exist with the airliners. You've got to have a stabilized approach. You've got to give yourself the edge to be able to deal with anything that comes up unexpectedly. And you need to take your time and make conscious decisions, not when you're diving down to make sure you're going to catch the numbers. That's a recipe maybe it's not a recipe for disaster, but it's a recipe to set yourself up for the second mistake that could be the disaster.
And keep in mind that this airport had a fairly small runway, 3,000 feet long, 60 feet wide, which is plenty large enough to land a small aircraft. However, this was something where at least this aircraft had not been to this airport in at least 3 months, perhaps never at all. So there's a whole issue of familiarity, both with the airport, with the performance of the aircraft that's fully loaded, which means you're going to have a higher speed to maintain stable flight at various levels. And again, this is something where, Greg, you're way more expert than we are. You're landing a small aircraft that has a normal landing speed of whatever it is. You suddenly put max gross weight on that airplane. What's the landing speed going to be like coming in for landing?
Well, again, you got temperature and wind conditions. I think that you looked at the wind, and even though they're landing on 2-1, I think the wind was from 170 or 160, you know, at what, 6 to 10 or maybe 12 knots? I can't remember for sure. But you got to factor all that in. It was a hot day, so you're going to be carrying some extra speed because you can't be dragging that airplane in. And if it is a profile like John was talking about, where you're, you know, diving and driving a little bit, you are going to have to manage the energy on the approach itself. Just looking at the ADS-B data, at least on the first aborted landing, it's obvious from the ADS-B data that he only cleared the trees. And again, those trees are only 350 feet off the end of the runway. He cleared the trees by roughly 200 feet on that first aborted landing. The question is now, how did the pilot get into the trees on the last landing attempt? Did he wait too long to make the decision to abort? Was he trying to put it down on the runway, finally decided that he was running out of runway and abandon it? Well, again, now your departure profile is going to be delayed, and you're going to be trying to outclimb the rising obstacle at the end of the runway, which in this case was 100-foot trees. And did the aircraft have the performance to be able to do that? Because you can't just haul back and stand the airplane on its tail and outclimb it. Was he making a turn? If you add a turn while you're trying to climb, your stall speed starts to go up. Did he stall the aircraft into those trees, or did he strike a tree while making that abandon or that go around? So, I mean, there are a lot of questions that need answers, and the NTSB investigators with the FAA and most likely Cirrus are going to have to answer. But you bring up a very good point, and it starts with, how familiar was this pilot with this airplane? Was this a new airplane to him or her? Did they go through Cirrus training? Did they have previous training in a Cirrus and they were upgrading? I mean, all of those questions, because that is part of understanding the aircraft performance. Just because it's a new smelling airplane and, you know, it's got a 310 horsepower engine, doesn't mean it's going to save you from being a bad pilot.
Let me ask you a personal experience question, Greg. How often when you go to a very first time into an airport where there's obstacles, trees, what have you, that's listed in the details of that airport, and in your mind's eye, you have a feeling of what it would look like when you approach, how often have you been fooled that looked even worse or not as bad as you thought coming in?
I've been fooled a couple times because I've gone into a number of airports, both in Maryland and Pennsylvania, where I grew up and learned to fly. Where you go into an airport, it's cut out of the trees or it's surrounded by trees. And yeah, on a sectional, of course, it's a runway. Great. And of course, when I was learning to fly, and it's not as long ago as John, when, you know, dirt was still being formed on the earth. But the fact that, you know, we didn't have the internet, I didn't have Google Earth, you fly over the airport and you're going, wow, those trees or that runway isn't what I perceived it to be based on the information I had read about. The perception I formed was totally different. And, you know, it's easy to get into an airport. It's not necessarily easy to get out of that same airport. And again, it's all based on performance. Does your airplane have the performance? You get into a 2,800 foot or 3,100 foot soft, because I've been into grass strips with my Comanche and that kind of thing, where, yeah, I mean, you know, I got 260 horsepower. I'm light loaded. I should be able to outclimb anything off the end of the 3,100 foot runway. But it all depends on your acceleration. It all depends on the temperature. It all depends on, you know, a variety of things. Next thing you know, you're sucking the gear up and you're flying over those trees at a lot lower altitude than you thought you'd be at. So these are the kinds of things, and we've talked about this in the past as part of the pre-flight prep, and that is the good thing about having an iPad or a telephone is you can actually pull up a Google Earth picture of the airport, really visually see those obstructions or obstacles at the end of both runways, and get a good mental picture of what it is that you're going to be entering into when you get into that airport environment.
You know, I've flown with people who never took that basic look at the airport. They flew in and just maybe set up for the approach and flew in. And only most of the time there was no problem, but only once did I ever feel like, uh-oh. And when we went too far into it, because then you realize, like you said, the trees and the terrain cause you pause. So I learned a lesson way back when about that. I haven't forgot it. I mean, you really got to do your homework. And it's just, you know, I'm sick of preaching at the end of every show, but we're trying to help people not have accidents. So I'm going to continue to do it. But it is frustrating. And it's frustrating as hell when Todd and I go through accident reports to put on here. And the number of times we come across the same scenario, poor planning, didn't read the weather, didn't have enough gas on board. I mean, just why are we repeating these?
Yeah. And then, and again, now you have a pilot who tried the first approach, abandoned it for whatever reason, and believed that he or she still had enough confidence in their personal skills, abilities, and knowledge to get the airplane down. So they came back and tried it again, and unfortunately was unsuccessful in a catastrophic way on the second attempt. When you look at these types of accidents, it's all about energy management, and FAA is stressing, especially in the airplane flying handbook and a lot of the pilot training, basic pilot training for private pilots, this term that used to be basically affiliated with flying larger, heavier aircraft called energy management. But if you're flying a machine that has any weight to it, it's all about managing the energy. You'd manage the energy in your car when you're trying to either accelerate up to 60 miles an hour or decelerate from 60 miles an hour because you got to stop. You're managing that energy by how much braking you're going to put, how much brake pressure you're going to use to get the car stopped. Same with the airplane. Cessna 172 or a Cirrus, you got to decelerate that airplane. You got to be on approach speed. You're trying to hit a target on the runway. And if you're a few knots fast, that matters. And again, that's why when you look at the performance charts, some of the performance charts will tell you that, you know, if you're two knots fast or three knots fast, you're going to increase your landing distance by 10, 20, even 30%. So again, and if you're flying a big airplane, a typical rule of thumb is for every knot above your approach speed, that's 100 feet further down the runway, you're going to be using that pavement. So again, it is about, you know, being a pilot and doing all the requisite activities and tasks necessary to plan for a successful flight. I'm sorry, go ahead.
One last point, which I forgot to mention. This flight into Kill Devil Hill was a short flight. It was about 8 minutes from takeoff to the loss of signal from the ADS-B, which means all the things you just mentioned, all the steps that had to be taken, all the prep mentally and otherwise, had to happen fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. If you're not on your game and planning every step of the way before you take off on an 8 minute flight, it's too late to think it up, to think it through halfway through the flight.
Yep. And then let's switch gears. Let's go further west now to Provo, Utah. You got an SR-22. This one is a little older. It's a 2001 model. Got two pilots on board, presumably. They call one a passenger, but I'm not sure. I've seen some of that as a mistake in the past early on, where they believe somebody sitting in the right seat was a passenger when in fact it could be a flight instructor. So we really don't know what was transpiring in this particular airplane, but we do know that there were two individuals up front, and of course one of them was flying. Again, looking at the ADS-B data, it looks like the airplane enters into a right downwind. They bleed the speed off, they get stabilized to an extent on the downwind. Rather than flying a square pattern, they actually do the roundhouse 180-degree turn from downwind to final. They're coming down final in that 85 to 90 knot range. And then as they get closer to the runway, it's obvious they're reconfiguring the airplane. They get the airplane slow to about 74, 75 knots ground speed just at the threshold. And of course, the airplane then accelerates and starts to climb. From some of the information that is available out there, I read one story where apparently there was another airplane on the runway that was slow clearing the runway, which necessitated these guys to abandon the landing. But they, again, made a climbing right turn back into the pattern on downwind. And this time, and again, I know that we both, or all of us have looked at that ADS-B data. It looks like a similar pattern from the downwind, except the base was started in that 180-degree type of turn, but it was shortly after that turn was initiated to the right, the ground speed had decreased to about 76 knots, as I recall, and witnesses described the airplane going into a stall spin. Because of the low altitude, they went into the water that's adjacent to the airport. Somebody had talked about that the parachute did fire. But if you're only, unless you're, you know, 600 feet or higher, even a delay as the airplane is descending, trying to pull that chute, have it rocket out and then blossom, it takes time. And the airplane in this case, unfortunately, hit the water. It hit the water with sufficient force, because I was reading another article about the recovery, that apparently the aircraft had sufficient force to go into the water and bury parts in the bottom. And I don't know how deep or what the depth of the water was, but they were pulling parts from 9 feet in the mud, in the water. So there was a lot of energy going vertical when that airplane hit. And again, you both have looked at this ADS-B data, and the commonality is here you have an abandoned, basically an abandoned landing, and they're getting back in the pattern, they're flying the airplane. What happened?
And the second commonality is the frequency of use of this airport. According to the Flight Aware again, it was 6 weeks between the last time this airplane had been at this airport to the accident day. Now, again, I don't know if the pilot was the one flying it all this time, but even if the pilot had been flying other aircraft into this airport, the fact is this particular aircraft apparently had only been to this airport 6 weeks prior to the accident day.
Yeah. So
you know, lack of being unfamiliar with an airport should have your antenna on very sensitive. You should be concerned about everything first time in, and especially with an airplane that's heavily loaded, short runway. I mean, we talk about it all, but I mean, just, you know, all of us as pilots are supposed to have a higher level of skills, ability, knowledge, and common sense than the average person. But boy, how many of these accidents, common sense is totally missing. You know, they might be great stick handlers for the airplane, but the knowledge seems to be missing.
Yeah, and the thing about this Provo accident is it's apparent that they were, again, they blasted on the downwind and were making that turn to get back on final to join the final, but they never really got past that first 90-degree turn because the speed bled off, their ground speed decreased significantly, and it's obvious that they may have gotten into an accelerated stall. And the question is, do you have a pilot or pilots that are unfamiliar, not necessarily with the airport, but with flying the airplane, trying to keep the airport in sight, trying to judge where I'm going to make the turn? Because we know that on downwind, you typically want to make the turn adjacent to a certain point, things like that. Are they looking out the window, not paying attention to airspeed, crank that wing up, get into a 30-degree bank, bleed that energy, or pulling like crazy to get the airplane turned around, holding altitude? I mean, there's so many questions that need to be answered. While we probably will never get those answers because it was a fatal accident, there's a lot to be said for the investigation, because again, it's going to take the investigator talking to people that know these two individuals on this airplane, finding those people that may have flown with one or both of them in the past, really understanding what their understanding of this airplane was. Was this a training flight? Was it a checkout flight? Whatever the case may be, because that's the real basis for the investigation and the basis for causes and contributing factors. Not the obvious that the pilot lost control and crashed the airplane. That doesn't tell you anything. It gives you the obvious. We already know that, and we're not even there. Question is, how did the pilot or pilots get themselves into this position? Just like Killdevil Hill, how did that pilot get him or her into that position that they either couldn't outclimb the obstructions at the end of the runway, or in this case, got the aircraft into a flight regime of a stall, stall, spin, stall, spiral, they're flying the traffic pattern. And we know that, yes, a lot of the accidents do happen in the traffic pattern, and it's because pilots are doing things, especially not monitoring airspeed and managing energy. They're distracted. They're looking out the window. They're trying to reposition. They're doing a bunch of different things, and it takes a lot of operational discipline. And these are the kinds of questions that need to be asked of a variety of different people to get the background so that when you do come up with a probable cause, we can all learn from the probable cause, other than the pilot lost control of the airplane while turning from downwind to base. That doesn't help the industry at all.
Now, there's a question I'd like to ask the both of you with respect to how the investigation will play out. And we've mentioned in some of the recent shows that there was a lack of investigative oomph in some of the reports we've seen. Do you think these are two events where they'll likely have an investigator on scene at some point to gather up information, or is this something where they're going to be doing it from a distance?
Well, we know, I was going to say real quick, Todd, we know that there'll always be an investigator. The question is it an NTSB investigator, or is it an FAA investigator, or a combination of both?
So the five fatals most likely will draw NTSB activity. The one in Provost, Utah, it's a toss-up. It depends on the workload. You know, as I've said in a few previous ones, I was looking at the budget for the NTSB since I left, essentially. And it's been pretty stagnant But yet we've had their 400 roughly employees getting pay raises every year. So if the budget doesn't go up, that means the money to do investigations is going down. And I think we're at a point today where it's been the lowest ever. So Chairman Comedy has to pick and choose her spots.
Wait. See, you went retro on us.
Yeah, I know. I saw that myself. I heard myself say that too. I heard myself say that too. All right. So she has to pick and choose her battle, so to speak, and where she's going to spend her money, because she doesn't have a lot and she's going to make it last the whole year. So it's a very, very difficult tightrope that they're walking right now.
Now, as we speak, it's October 1st, the beginning of the fiscal year for the U.S. federal government. So they're at the point of the year where they have all the budget that they know that they're going to have for the whole year, and they have the option of spending a little bit extra on this accident or these two accidents. Think it'll happen?
No.
No, I don't think they got to space it out for the whole year. Just because you're flush today doesn't mean, you know, what happens next August? Summertime flying. So here they're coming into the winter. So here in the Northeast, right, the flying is going to go down. So there's not going to be as many accidents here in the Northeast through the winter with general aviation because people just don't fly. Right. So now what happens if they spend all their money out west and down south during the winter? And when we get May, June, July, and August in New England or the cold weather states, we get a whole bunch of crashes and they don't have any money.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, the board's gonna do what the board's gonna do. I don't care if the NTSB investigator doesn't go to the accident site, which we know under a lot of the circumstances they don't. They have the FAA go out and do all the on-site stuff, collect whatever they can. But the process of follow-up, you've got to get on the phone. You've got to track people down. You can still do that from the office. You can still do thorough and methodical from the office. You don't just take the obvious and write it off to loss of control for unknown reasons or loss of control because the pilot failed to maintain airspeed. That's obvious. We're talking about it right now, 3 days, 4 days after the accident. Tell me why they did that. You can find out pretty well why that may have happened. And so that's what's going to help benefit all of us who look at accidents, dissect accidents, and want to learn from these accidents so that we can either pass the information on or incorporate it into our own respective flying. And I think that the lessons learned here are, you know, go back to what John preaches, and that is pre-flight planning. No matter what you're doing, whether you're going to stay in the pattern and do a training flight or do touch and goes or you know, work on your landings and that kind of stuff, or like Kill Devil Hill, yeah, you want to take your family and friends and you want to go show them an airport and do all that, that's great. But again, if this was a new airplane and you don't have familiarity, you don't understand the performance, you've never been into a short runway, especially one with a lot of obstructions or obstacles at the end, you have to plan for it. You have to plan for the A part of the flight that is getting in and the B part of the flight is getting out. And you can't just wait till you get there to do it. And you should use all the tools, and we've got a lot of tools available to us as pilots now to be very familiar with what it is we're going to be doing with that aircraft.
And but because of those tools, it means you don't do less, you have to do twice as much, because you still have to do what we should have been doing all along manually, and then you can use the automation to augment it. Too many people, and I have this discussion at FBOs all the time when I see it, too many people rely upon that automation and don't do the basics. And that's so, so freaking important.
Yeah.
Now this
so Todd, with that, I'm sorry.
It segues into my second to last word. You were about to give me that.
Yep, I was going to let you have the second to the last word, my friend.
Well, the thing that's common between these two events are unfamiliarity. In both cases, that aircraft had not been to the accident site airport for several weeks or several months. Maybe not at all. If that's something that's happening in your flight, you're doing something for the very first time, take extra time to go through the details of what's happening. One of those flights was all of 8 minutes long, and it was a full flight, five people on board for an airplane that had four or five seats. I think it was four seats in this airplane. That's definitely unusual. Two things unusual, three things. Never been to the airport before, apparently. Full flight, very short flight. A lot of planning has to go into that, and that planning will be much longer than the flight itself. Don't hesitate to do what is necessary to make sure you got your bases covered.
And based on that, John, I will leave you with our last word.
Actually, I think I'll change it a little bit. It's more going to be a plea. I'm tired of saying the same thing at the end of the show. Please, all of you, do the pre-planning. Do a good pre-flight. Put your head on a swivel when you take off and don't go into somebody else's midair. And please, please do the basics. I want to be able to say something different. And I've been saying it for 200 and almost 250 shows. The same thing, because all we're doing is seeing the same accidents. Let's have something new. Let's get rid of these old ones and start focusing on something else. So
yeah,
please,
the positive side of aviation instead of the negative.
Yes. So please, if you're going to go flying, do a good job with the basics. Plan. Do a great walk around. Keep your eyes and ears open when you're flying, and fly safely, please.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that. And we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.